You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. Join me as we uncover the rich histories of North America's Great Plains, exploring the latest archaeological discoveries and past cultures that shape this storied region. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to episode 40 of the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. I am your host, Professor Carlton Schildschief-Gover, and I'm thrilled to have you join me as we explore the fascinating and rich histories of North America's Great Plains. Incredibly excited to have Dr. Christopher Nicholson here on the podcast. Chris, are you the director of TDAR? Like, what is your official title at Arizona State University?
Yeah, my fancy title is Associate Research Professor in the School of Human Evolution and Social Change, the fancy term for the anthropology department. And then my secondary title is Executive Director for the Center for Digital Antiquity. And we're the ones who oversee the TDAR, or Digital Archaeological Record Repository.
Awesome. And so I first met Chris when I was a sniveling master's student at the University of Wyoming. I'm pretty sure like during my first or second year. And you were working, was it like the Water Survey?
Yeah, so I worked for the Water Resources Data System in Wyoming State Climate Office, and I was the director of those offices. And they were funded by the state of Wyoming to catalog and track water data and usage in the state, which is it's a really big thing there, you know, with the Colorado River Compact and everything else. So I had a unique position. We were in the School of Engineering, actually, and nothing to do with anthropology or archaeology.
And that's your background, though, right? Like, you have a PhD in anthropology.
It is. Actually, my PhD in anthropology is from the University of Wyoming. While I was working as the director for the Water Center, I was taking classes toward my PhD.
Excellent. Who's your advisor?
Todd Servelle.
Oh, that's right. It was Todd. How'd you think of his most recent paper?
I thought it was really interesting. I'm interested to see what the community thinks about it. I've read some, you know, short snippets here and there. But absolutely. Actually, after I read it, I said, hey, can I get those data?
Sweet. That's awesome. And shameless plug over to the Ethnosinology podcast, where David Ian Howe has already released. He recorded with Todd months before. So once the press embargo was over, David's video with Todd was out. And then last night, we're recording this on March 25th. And on March 24th, myself, Jesse Toon, and Shane Miller, and Spencer Pelton were a panel guest on David's podcast, where we've talked about the reaction to Todd's paper. So go ahead and give that a listen. But back to you, Chris. So what exactly is TDAR, and how and why was it created?
So TDAR is, you know, it's just a piece of software. It's a digital archive, digital repository that was started. It was a brainchild of Dr. Keith Kintig out of Arizona State back in the late 2000s. And around 2008 or 2009, he got an NSF grant to build a data interoperability tool. He is really interested in data synthesis across time and space, and he wanted a way to bring in different types of data sets to be able to integrate those and then to say something a little bit larger about human behavior. So he got this grant from NSF, and then he got funding from the Mellon Foundation to build it out even further and create the center. So in 2010, they were able to actually launch the repository software. And from then on, it's been ingesting data sets, documents, images. And we've transitioned a little bit. We don't do as much data integration as we would like. And we really kind of just focus on the long-term preservation of those documents and images and data sets. But it's sort of a multifaceted platform, and it's undergone some changes, and hopefully we'll continue to make improvements on it.
And you guys also accept like conference posters and conference papers, right? Things that wouldn't traditionally get citations or DOIs, but you also provide a mechanism for these things that are often just either rolled back up and like lost in a closet somewhere, or just die on a student's personal login when they graduate.
Yeah, we have a great agreement with the SHA and the SAA to ingest all of their abstracts. And then if anybody wants to upload their poster or conference presentation, they can do it for free. It already has the abstract, the title, and everything. They can send us that information. And then you have something that's citable, right? It's archived. You can point somebody to that DOI, that digital object identifier. You can put it on your CV so somebody can click on it and actually see the work that you've done. It's really a shame that, you know, gosh, if you think about the SAA in the thousands and thousands of posters that get done, and they never really go anywhere, but it's a wealth of information. So, you know, we always tell students, listen, this is a great way to put out your work. It's a great way to save your intellectual property, you know, promote yourself, demonstrate that you've done some research and can put together, you know, a coherent argument. So we really think it's a great tool. We'd love to see more people do it. Unfortunately, I don't think it gets used as much as it could. So I guess this is also a shameless plug. Send me your conference posters.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's a great caveat. So, I mean, like, how does TDAR and the work you do? Well, actually, even back up, like, how many people work at TDAR? Like, how big is your staff and what is it they do that supports this project?
So we've got myself, the center director. Then I have two digital curators. I have two programmers, a project administrator. And then we have a short-term contract data specialist who's working on a project with the Defense POW MIA accounting agency. And then I have a contract with the Forest Service to do digital curation in California. And I've got six digital, we call them digital archaeologists, whose job it is to help the forest scan those materials and then upload their data to the NRM Heritage Web platform. So right now, I think I'm hovering around 12 employees. So it's, you know, and it depends on the contracts we get. And that's, you know, we're always looking to work with different folks. And so, it, you know, our employment sort of ebbs and fades based on the folks that we're helping.
You guys have a larger staff than like some anthropology programs, and it's towards this. Crazy. And it's just incredible to see the resources, and that you're also plugged into Arizona State's like anthro department and larger, because what do you guys call it? SHESH?
Or SHESH. What is it?
Yeah.
The School of Human Evolution and Social Change. Yeah. I don't know what year that they made that change from the Department of Anthropology, but that department itself, man, the total department has probably 60 or 70 faculty members from, you know, cultural, biological, archaeology. And so the archaeology faculty there is fantastic. You know, I've never been in a department with better camaraderie, I'll be honest. And there's a lot of them that are really interested in digital preservation too. So it makes it a great place to work.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this might be a good way to kind of come back after introducing, like, just kind of like how, not only that you guys are in a prominent department, you have a large staff, you're surrounded by an excellent community. So how does TDAR, and you kind of already mentioned this a little bit, how does TDAR support open access and broader research visibility beyond just allowing a citation or a link that someone can click on to check out someone's CV if they're applying for a job?
Yeah, so we really focus on the long-term preservation of information, but that's only one part of it. It's not, you know, just to preserve something for just for the sake of preservation. It doesn't mean as much as it could, right? Really, the value of something is where when it gets reused. So we really want to support the discovery, access, and reuse of information with the caveat that it's not always open access. There's sort of the open access conundrum, especially for information that's culturally sensitive, geographically sensitive. So when we think about open access, we actually think of it within this idea of the fair and care principles, making things findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable, but couching that in this ethical framework around the CARE principles, which were put out by Stephanie Carroll Russo's group out of University of Arizona around indigenous data sovereignty. That means, you know, is there a collective benefit to that preservation? Who has the authority to control it? What's the responsibility and ethics behind it? So really, even though we are supporting open access, we want to make sure that it's not everything is made accessible. That, and I think that's a key part of this. It's not, it's got to be done in a manner that's in tandem with tribes or in descendant communities too. So that's a major part of what we're concerned about.
Excellent. And so bridging off that, you guys recently hosted a workshop. Is that fair to call it? You guys had a grant funded workshop. And what was the purpose of the all the folks? Who is it that you all brought in? What was the purpose of it? And what are you guys hoping to achieve in order to advance, you know, the mission and breadth of TDAR?
TDAR currently accepts a lot of different images, including 3D images, but we don't do a great job with 3D images. And so we've kind of had this brainchild of creating something called TDAR 3D as an alternative to Sketchfab. You know, Sketchfab's designed to, so you can visualize 3D objects, but it's not designed to archive them. And there's no real, you know, ethical platform or settings to make it a true archive. So I wrote a Wennergren grant proposal for a workshop, and we hosted I think there's about 20 of us that came to ASU back in February. Carlton, you were lucky enough to attend, get that invitation.
But very lucky. It was nuts being there, dude.
It was great. A really diverse group of people. We had some tribal representation. We had an archaeologist from Egypt who is part of their ministry for antiquities and tourism. We had the former cultural director, I guess, for Sketchfab or the cultural heritage department. We had several archaeologists from cultural resource management firms, from Chronicle Heritage and from, I think it's EPG. And then we have had a bunch of academics too. So it was, how can we bring these folks together and think about what are the ethical policies that we need to institute if we're going to have a really robust and, ethical 3D archive? What is it that we should be considering? And then just aside from the policy side of it, what's the front end going to look like? What is the back end going to look like? What are the widgets that you want to see? And what's the information that we would actually need on the back end to support some type of ethical framework? And we I love things like, metadata to include, is this a NAGPRA item or NAGPRA related item? Or is this an item that's been created in conjunction with a certain community? So can we build out some type of digital infrastructure to make TDAR 3D a better platform than just throwing something on Sketchfab?
Absolutely. And so the workshop was 3 days. Three intense days. And what I enjoyed most about it, I was not on the technical side. When you guys started talking about metadata and some of the other things, I was more like, all right, just going to watch people cook. It's always awesome to see people who are really good at something talk about how good they are at something with other people that are good at it. It was just kind of fun to be in the room. But in terms of how you and your staff ran that workshop, was easily the most rewarding workshop I think I've been a part of. How you guys just kind of allowed a natural flow, allowed the participants to have agency over the direction, but just kind of played more like referees than coaches, and just keeping everything in bounds and within the field of play rather than being rules lawyers. So that was just a lot of fun to be a part of.
Yeah, you folks were hand selected pretty closely in terms of we've read most of those people's stuff. We had an idea about their disposition, and all we wanted to do was lay down this general roadmap and then absorb your information. I didn't want to be driving that train. I just wanted to be riding it. And so it was great to actually just hear the ideas. And I think I took 25 pages of single spaced notes, and I wrote down everything. And, now I'm going through it and compiling it and looking for themes and pulling stuff together, because I want to be able to send something back to Wintergrand and demonstrate that this was actually there's going to be something that comes out of this. There's going to be a tangible product that meets the criteria that we hope. And honestly, without the input that you guys gave, we would have been, not where we are today with that.
That's awesome. And I always love getting Bernard's business cards, what his little 3D printed.
Bernard Means.
Dude, it was just such a fun group to be around. I'm really appreciative.
Yeah, that was great.
So with that, we'll be right back with Dr. Nicholson after these messages. And welcome back. So for this next half, this latter half of the episode, this is the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. So we do want to highlight Great Plains materials that are currently in TDAR. So, right off the bat, what do you got from the Great Plains and TDAR?
That was a great question. When you asked me to come over here, I was like, man, I really got to, maybe I'll have to do some digging. Two things just absolutely popped out to me. The first is something called the Colorado Projectile Point Database. And we worked with a group out of Colorado, a CRM firm out of Montrose. And they put together a image gallery of all the projectile points from across Colorado. So I understand there's the Intermountain West there, but they also included the plains. But it's a great resource because they have images from private collectors, but also museums, and they took standardized pictures of these. So there's, I think we have, I'm going to say 7,000 to 9,000 images of projectile points from specifically Colorado, and then we have all their attribute data. So if you're interested in lanceolate points that are chert, you can actually go onto TDAR and find those types of images and then see how they compare to your collection. There's no chronological names to them. So there isn't Pelican Lake and whatever else, Hell Gap. They really kept it basic. So I think it's an interesting collection for just people to browse and get a sense of, you know, the breadth of projectile points from across the state. So that was one collection that came to mind. And then the second one is something I actually did with Spencer Pelton. We actually went and took from the Wyoming Archaeological Society. We took all their back issues of the Wyoming Archaeologist and put them on TDAR with the idea that each individual article back, I think we go from like 1993 to 2021. So all of those now are indexed within TDAR. They have a DOI that makes them citable. And I think this makes these all of these articles a lot more findable. And they're great. I mean, just the breadth of information that's been in that journal over time, we wanted to make it a lot more visible. And so, you know, site reports, all sorts of information is in that publication. So we love that the fact that we can hopefully make it a little bit more visible. And that's been another key thing. We see a lot of these smaller journals starting to go under because of publication costs and everything. So if we can support making sure that information is preserved, that'll be a key thing that we do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, and that's kind of cool that I imagine, was it Alpine out of Montrose?
No, it was Coal Creek.
Huh.
It's a small mom and pop shop. They were actually engineers. And later in life, they decided they wanted to be archaeologists. So they went back and got the training, started their own shop. And this was a major project that they wanted to do.
That's great. I mean, that kind of inspires me like on a whole different tangent, because like we've been playing around with the idea with the former state archaeologist of Kansas about doing like a lithic inventory of Kansas, and also moving away from the colloquial names to the characteristical styles, just like, is it a stem point? Like, what's the size? And, you know, to move away from things like Pelican Lake or Oxbow, just like meaningless names. So I'm going to have to peruse into it. So how do you think Plains archaeologists or students working in Great Plains Archaeology can benefit from using the platform?
There's just so much information and data on TDAR. And a lot of it stems, what are you curious about? What gets you jazzed about archaeology? And the thing about TDAR is you can explore it. You can say, okay, I want South Dakota. I want ceramics. I want data sets or documents, and then try to find it. And then, you know, based on your own research interest, can you start to pull in these data sets from other places, from other researchers that maybe you never knew existed? And then can you reuse that information in some type of synthetic way? Maybe you want to know about subsistence patterns across the entire Great Plains. You can't do it one site at a time. You've got to have collections of sites. And so this is a place where you can easily find faunal data sets or lithic data sets. So that's what I think is exciting, is like, what's your question? What gets you excited? And go look for it. This is, you know, a catalog to find something to support your research.
Now, something we haven't touched on, is it free? Like, when you create an account for TDAR, do you have to pay? Is there a subscription? Like, how accessible is the platform itself? Like, how are you guys, where's the money? What, is there any money involved?
Yeah, so there is. To download something from TDAR is free. So anybody can come into TDAR, you register, you put your email, you know, who you are, maybe what your affiliation is, and you can go and download anything for free. If you want to preserve your information, we do have data curation fees associated with that. So anything less than 100 files, I think it's $20 per 50 megabytes. And I will say that's negotiable, because we're starting to learn that, you know, people with large image data sets, it's not a practical cost. We're seeing people that have LiDAR that's just incredibly big. But if you're talking about just small sets of data or documents, it's relatively inexpensive. It's when you start getting into large volumes. And that's honestly where we're largely funded. We have partners at the Air Force and other folks that are uploading thousands and thousands of resources. And so a lot of our funding comes from that client partnership that we have through data curation and through those upload fees.
Excellent. So, I mean, the fact that it's free to download, right, sounds like an incredible resource, especially for students. Like, as being, I guess, somewhat fresh out of being a grad student, having to search at the time, like either CU libraries, and that's completely dependent. If I look for an article, it's completely dependent on which publishers my university has a relationship with. And so there's some journals I'm just absolutely locked out of. Like at KU, we don't have a subscription to Routledge. Like, really? I don't have access to Plains Anthropologist. Oh. And so, like, I have to sign on to my Plains account in order to access it, which is one of the first times. And as you said, a lot of these smaller publishers are going under, especially with academia's drive towards, what is it called, the research index or the index value?
Yeah, index values. Yeah.
Right. Like how, you know, you might be publishing 20 articles, but like in what are they premier journals? And what's the likelihood? And as we've also seen, that has created a larger wait time between accepted in publication. And so we're seeing this really weird lag, but having something like TDAR can become this one-stop shop as long as people are using it in a way. And I've used TDAR for the P3K project, like to have all those radiocarbon dates in a spreadsheet from like what, 2000, when it was what, Eric and Jacob and I think Judson was involved.
Yeah. Judson Finley. Yeah. I think we published that in 2020. No, man, what year is it? Maybe 2021. But yeah, it's hundreds of thousands of radiocarbon dates that anybody can look at and use for whatever.
From across the globe. Yeah. Like when my grad student has benefited from it, she was doing a broad radiocarbon analysis from the Southeast and she had no idea where to start. And I was like, oh, I had another intern divide all the radiocarbon dates by state in different files. Mm-hmm. Just go onto that. And then you can always, then you can use that in association with CARD, the Canadian Archaeological Radiocarbon Database, and just see if new dates have been done since 2021. Mm-hmm. And granted, you're still missing, like you need to look at the publications from the last 5 years to see if new sites have been dated, but like almost every radiocarbon date ever collected from across the globe on TDAR up to 2021 is nuts.
The idea is that it can really lower the amount of time that a student needs to do a project. If they can find data and information in one spot to make it easier to do their thesis, that's what we want to be able to do, right? I mean, I look back at, you know, my PhD was a compilation of sites from across Western Eurasia. And I actually had to mine the literature to find, you know, sites from the Eemian period. I had to find, you know, their latitude and longitude. And I feel like half of my dissertation was just munging around in publications trying to find it. You know, I would have killed for a data set just to be readily out there. And I put my dissertation stuff out there because I want to be able to, you know, sort of pay it forward. But it's the same thing with all this. Can you pay it forward with your research? Can somebody else benefit? I think that's, especially for students, I think that's key.
Well, I mean, I was even thinking about it. The fact, like, I will often use, you know, at conferences like the SAAs, show my upcoming radiocarbon research, but I get like really weird about having radiocarbon dates, like having that data on a poster when it's not published yet.
Right.
But having something like TDAR, where if I can just upload my poster, so there's still that Shield Chief 2025 citation. Yes. It makes me more comfortable. Not that I want to gatekeep data, but there is a responsibility of like, well, if I paid for a radiocarbon date being like, what, $350 from Beta?
Right.
And I'm, you know, that's a couple $1,000 at times that I want to make sure that I paid for. I get acknowledged as the one who did it, not someone who like walked by and clicked, took a photo of it, and now just has a bunch of radiocarbon dates.
Right. Protecting intellectual property. Honestly, that's part of it.
Absolutely. So, what is the open call? Like, how can more people contribute their data to TDAR?
We actually just ran a special in February. We called it Free File February Uploads, where we waive the prices for uploading materials because we do want to lower barriers. You know, the thing is, we do have to keep the lights on at TDAR. But the thing is, if you've got a project, if you've got an idea for a curation thing, the biggest thing is just come talk to us. We're flexible. We want to encourage projects that think outside of, you know, maybe an individual site and how can, you know, maybe pull in images or data sets from multiple sites and do something. Or, we just want to make sure that you've also got guidance, because I think a lot of people just don't even know where to start. It's a little intimidating, like, oh, curation, that seems, you know, I was never trained to be a curator. But it's, you know, we can help with that. You know, we have programmers or on staff that, if you do have a list of 1,000 images, you know, we can actually work with you to do this. I'm actually in talks with, speaking of Plains archaeologists, with Larry Todd right now, thinking about his collection, his legacy collection as an emeritus faculty from sites like Bugis Holding and Vore and Hudson Meng and Kaplan Hoover. You know, that guy has got a wealth of information out there, and we want to work with him. You know, I'm biased because I'm a toddler. I was a Larry Todd student. But, you know, how can we help emeritus faculty get their legacy collections on data so that it can benefit future generations. So just biggest thing I'd say is if you're nervous about it, just call me, send me a note. We'll hook you up.
Absolutely. I don't mean to derail, but it was good seeing Larry at the workshop.
Yeah.
And when I asked Larry how he was doing, he was like, great, but you know, the national parks won't take my recommendation as to hire snipers to shoot looters in the bighorns. So I'm like, I can wonder why. It sounds like a good idea though. We should do more of that. I wish more of our federal money went towards that. Dude, he just cracks me up. Fantastic.
If only Larry were in charge.
If only Larry were in charge. Amen. Well, good stuff. So final thoughts, man, Chris, like, why does digital preservation matter for the future of our field?
When we go to a site, you know, we always make this argument that this information is irreplaceable. We destroy sites when we excavate them and we pull out artifacts, we pull out all the dirt, and we make these statements about the importance of the archaeological record, and we spend a ton of money on generating data, but it doesn't feel like we're there in terms of making sure that data and information is preserved for the next generation of archaeologists and for the public. And honestly, the public, in a lot of cases, I think has rights to this information on public lands and what's going on. And I think there's a lot of folks out there, pseudo-archaeologists who make statements about archaeology. And, you know, the fact is we've got a platform for the public to come in and take a look at some of that stuff. That was honestly that referencing Joe Rogan and the debate between Flint Dibble and Graham Hancock. Within the first 14 minutes, Flint, you know, referenced TDAR and said, listen, if you're going to make these grandiose statements about ancient aliens or whatever else, well, why don't you actually look at the data first? And we actually have a platform for people to go and look at the data. But we need archaeologists to continue to contribute to combat that kind of rhetoric.
Absolutely. Well, awesome. Thank you so much, Chris. So where can listeners access TDAR and how do they get started?
That's a good question. I feel like I should know that URL off the top of my head. It's actually core.tdar.org, core.tdar.org. Browse it. Actually, if you're an archaeologist listening, you can TDAR your own name in there. Look yourself up, see what might surprise you that we have in there. And for the public, explore it. Take a look and see what might be in there. I think that might interest you.
Absolutely. And for those listening to the episode, you can find the link to TDAR in the episode description. So you can just go right ahead and open up your mobile phone or your web browser and click right on over. Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. Where can our listeners contact you at?
They can contact me at my email, my ASU email. It's christopher.m.nicholson@asu.edu. Send me a note.
Excellent. And that will also be in the show notes. Actually, his whole ASU faculty profile will be there and his email is in there. So cool. Click on that if you need to get a hold of Chris. All right. And with that, everybody, this has been episode 40 of the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. Next episode, we're going to have Dr. Laura Murphy on the show to talk about some Kansas archaeology. So stay tuned. Thank you for listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. You can follow me on Instagram at Pawnee_archaeologist, and you can also email me at greatplainsarcpodcast@gmail.com. And remember, anybody can love the mountains, but it takes a soul to love the prairie. American author Willa Cather.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.